Last Sunday morning, as we were getting ready for a meeting at St. Lydia's at 304 Bond Street, a man walked through the door and he just walked straight through the space to where we were back in the kitchen. And he said, "Are you open yet?" And this happens to me pretty regularly when I'm there at St. Lydia's during the week. And so I said right in flow, "Oh, we're not a restaurant. We're a dinner church and we're setting up for a meeting." And as typically happens when people make this mistake, he looks around and he's like, "Oh, wow, that's cool." Like, you know, not wanting to be disparaging, but kind of like unsure what to say. And he had hoped to get change. You know, he had some like a $20 bill in his hand or something. And we don't have a cash register, obviously. And I didn't have any cash at all in my pocket. So we just wished him well on his way with the invitation to return at 6 p.m. for dinner church if that sounded like a good thing for him. On Saturday then, this week, we were down on Pearl Street. And we stopped to check out Francis Tavern. I thought, is that an accident that the oldest, most historic building in New York is a tavern, a restaurant? It was built by Stephen DeLancey as a family home in 1719, and it's cool because it has imported yellow Dutch bricks. So it's like a sign back to the Dutch colony before the British. And Samuel Francis bought it in 1762, and he opened was known then as the Queen's Head Tavern because he had a big picture of the Queen hanging out in front of the tavern. It wasn't actually the name of the tavern. People just called it the Queen's Head Tavern. It was the site of both public and clandestine meetings that played a role in the Revolutionary War. George Washington hung out there. And it just made me think like how much neighborhood restaurants and pubs are community gathering places. Places where we can connect with one another, cry, laugh, make plans, even plot revolution. I can think of some meetings Liz and I have had plotting some kind of revolution. They're places where, as it were, our hunger is fed. And not just our physical hunger. They're places that feed us on a psychological level, even on a spiritual one. Now, I know I'm going to date myself generationally, but it made me think of a show I didn't even watch very much, but it was so in the cultural ethos that it just made sense to come up at this point in my sermon. It's a long-running sitcom about a bar in Boston. And the theme song by Gary Portnoy just hits this. And so sing along, you know, if this is something you're familiar with. Feel free to sing along.
Making your way in the world.
I know Jesus didn't own a bar or a restaurant, but it just feels like if he did, it would be like Cheers. It would be this place where he always knew your name. And it's true that he was always eating and drinking with people. In John's Gospel, which we read tonight, there are signs, I think 6 or 7, depending on which scholar you follow, in John's Gospel, and each one of these signs is supposed to like divulge something about how Jesus' identity as God's chosen one is revealed to us as the hearers. And, you know, the first sign, the famous first sign is the wedding at Cana in Galilee. You probably know this story. Mid-party, they run out of wine. Jesus' mother elbows him in the side, and she says, "Jesus, they ran out of wine." And he says, "Ma, okay." So he tells the steward to fill 6 stone jars full of water and then asks the steward to take a cup of the supposedly water to the bridegroom. He drinks it and he says, "Most people use the good wine first, but you saved the best wine till now." That's the first sign, a party, a celebration. And then in this story, the hungry multitudes gather to hear Jesus. And Jesus prompts his disciples to feed the people, but they balk, saying it would cost 6 months' wages. One of them, however, bravely points to a boy with 5 loaves and 2 fishes. And Jesus takes them and gives thanks and distributes them. And lo and behold, all have enough with baskets left over. So Jesus' signs, the sign of the wedding at Cana, this sign of the feeding of the multitude, seek to meet people's need. Jesus' practices are interesting to observe. He doesn't always see the need, like his mom told him what the problem was at the wedding. He didn't see it. But here he did see that the people were gathered and were hungry. And when he becomes aware of the need, he responds. He insists on responding. It can prove an intellectual barrier, for me anyway, if we focus on the seemingly impossible, like the literal translation of water into wine, or the literal stretching of 5 loaves and 2 fish to feed thousands of hungry people. For me, as a post-critical thinker, the literal level of truth of these stories doesn't work for me. Yet, I really have learned from the French philosopher Paul Ricoeur, who talks about like having a first naivete in which you approach scripture and you just take it on sort of face value, and then go through a second phase, a critical examination of the scripture in which you think, wait a minute, you know, this doesn't add up in terms of what I know about science, in terms of what I know about physics. Like this, like I can't repeat that. This is not a repeatable experiment, if you will. And then he says, but it's possible to have a what he calls a second naivete, like a space beyond the critical examination of scripture in which you realize, oh, but there is a really profound truth in this scripture after all. It's not just that I deconstruct it and say, well, it's of no value, it's of no truth. And for me, the truth is the narrative truth of these stories. And that truth is even more powerful than the factual truth, because I can go and do likewise as Jesus commands us to do. If the truth of the story is when you see people's needs, seek a way to respond to it. If it's me turn water into wine, then it's like, well, Jesus did it, but that's it. That's the end of it. So responding to people's hungers for sustenance, for healing, for recognition, for justice, Jesus often uses plain ordinary things at hand for meeting people's needs. At home, he uses stone jars and water. Out in the hillside, he uses what a boy has, a couple of loaves and a couple of fish. I think the writer of John's Gospel wanted us to see not practices of scarcity and fear, but practices of abundance and of care. The miracle of the sign Jesus performs is not its superhuman character, I don't think, but its utter ordinariness, his caring for people in community. Take, for example, this feeding of the multitudes. Jesus, the text says, tells everyone to sit down in the big grassy field. I can imagine them sitting down and Jesus saying to them, so here's what I got, what do y'all got? And they all check their bags and pull out what they got and they all share, and lo and behold, there's enough, even more than enough. There's leftovers. This sermon today is a part of a series of reflections I am doing that lead up to the Feast of St. Lydia next weekend. And last Sunday, I talked a little bit about the architecture of St. Lydia's in relationship to our gospel. And tonight, I want to reflect on our practices, because I think this text really focuses on what Jesus does, his practices in relationship to people in need. And I thought about how St. Lydia's privileges practice over belief. The core of our life together is what we do together. And it struck me that St. Lydia's is a place where, like Cheers, everyone knows your name. Like on Zoom, we all have our names listed and many of us our pronouns and some of us the roles that we're playing. But when we show up at St. Lydia's on 304 Bond Street, we all have little name tags hanging on our shirt. And they're all the same. Visitors don't get a different name tag than long-timers. We whether you're there for the first time or you've been coming forever, get the same kind of name tag. And then when we share the Eucharist, we say to one another, Heidi, this is my body. We say our names to one another. For in-person worship, and to some extent on Zoom too, like everybody has a role, or at least a lot of people have roles. It's a participatory church, like we make church together. When we meet at 304 Bond Street, people share in cooking, people share in cleaning up. In person or on Zoom, we share in the leadership roles that make church. That's really important too, whether you're a relative newcomer or whether you've been coming for a long time. We invite people into roles and make them accessible. A tougher practice, but one that we're really grappling with, is how we learn to take deeper care with structures of oppression that play out in our life together. How do we intentionally structure a space that welcomes voices that our society so often dismisses? A patriarchal society, or a racist society, or a trans or homophobic society dismisses voices, and we struggle with what are the practices that help us open a space in which people can more fully appear. Then lastly, like Jesus, I think we take ordinary domestic things, tables, chairs, pots and pans, aprons, food, as the setting in which the Spirit moves within and between us. So I think healing comes from this space to appear that these practices help to create. A space to appear, to be nourished in mind, body, and soul, to find oneself miraculously not alone. If Christian beliefs like that God is the Holy Trinity are true, that's awesome. But St. Lydia's wager is that we're much less likely to grasp what that concept of God as Holy Trinity might mean without experiencing the practice of being in community with one another, where we are known and loved and made whole. If we experience and know that, then we might know something of what it might mean to say God is in community with God's self. We share the sermon here at St. Lydia's, and we'll spend a few moments in silent reflection, and then when you hear the bell sound, you're invited to share a story or an experience that the scripture text sparked for you, or my reflections. At St. Lydia's, we have two invitations for you. One is that we listen to one another's stories without praising them or critiquing them, just letting the stories sit side by side. And secondly, that we encourage thinking about the space we take up or that we allow to be available for others. Our society makes assumptions about who should and will take up space, and we try to invite a consciousness about that so that we might make space for others potentially if we often take up space, or we might take up space if we're often encouraged to not appear, to not show up and take space and voice. So as we consider these ways of holding space. We begin in silence, and when you hear the bell, then you're invited to share stories and experiences.